from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a new year and a big year in American politics. And yet we know and have known for a while that something isn't right, that something isn't working to renew and refresh our great republic. Activist and legal scholar Lawrence Lessig says it's no secret. It's the corrupting money in our politics. It's time, he says, to fix it, and he's got a plan. This hour on Point. Happy New Year. Let's save the nation. You can join the conversation. How do we right the ship, get moving, be our best again? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Lawrence Lessig, South Dakota, born Pennsylvania, raised, jumped in as a young Republican. Now he's professor of law and director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. He made his name in copyright law and the internet. Now he's gone much bigger. He is founder with Democratic political strategist Joe Trippi of Root Strikers, a network of activists fighting money in politics. His new book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig, Happy New Year. Great to have you right here.
Great to be here.
All right. We think we know this. We think we know that money is a problem. What's the bigger picture that you're giving us here that we don't know? Tell us something new about that problem.
Well, I think the critical thing is to get people on the left and people on the right both to recognize that while they don't have a common end, they have a common enemy. And the common enemy is this system of corruption, which systematically distorts what our government does, whether our government is controlled by the left or controlled by the right.
You say corruption, but you're not exactly talking about money delivered in bags to congressmen.
Yeah, that's right. A century ago, when the United States, for really the first time in its history, organized an extraordinary movement against, quote, corruption and succeeded in eliminating that kind of corruption. The corruption they were talking about was brown paper bag corruption, Rob Blagojevich corruption, the kind of corruption where people are breaking the law.
I want some money for this
exactly
favor.
Right. That's not the corruption of Washington today. I don't know about states. I don't know about cities. But that's not the corruption of Washington today. Washington today is filled with lots of very honest, hardworking, decent people who think they live within the rules of a system they didn't themselves design. But it's the system itself that systematically distorts what our government does relative to what the people wanted to do. And it's that system which is the corruption, not necessarily the people inside.
How is it frustrating both the dreams, the ambitions of the left and of the right?
Well, the left is obvious, right? We've just seen a president who came to power promising all sorts of changes which have been systematically blocked by interests that don't want those changes, whether it's health care or global warming legislation. You pick the issue, and Obama has suffered the consequences of this corruption. The more counterintuitive examples are the examples on the right. So people on the right talk about having a simpler tax system, for example.
Yep.
Presidential candidate Kaine or Rick Perry talk about radically simplifying the tax system. But what they don't think about is the way that our current tax system, with all of its complexities, is in part designed to make it easier for candidates, in particular congressmen, to raise money to get back to Congress. So all sorts of special exceptions, which expire after a limited period of time, are just a reason to pick up the phone and call somebody and say, your exception's about to expire. Here's a good reason for you to help us in the fight to get it to extend. And that gives them the opportunity to practice what is really a kind of extortion, shaking the trees of money in the private sector into campaign coffers so that they can run for Congress again.
So you're saying if by right you mean somebody on the right means they really believe in the power of the free market to make things work out great, the free market itself is being undermined, you're saying, by this flow of sort of slush political contributions that come back into Congress.
Absolutely. And it's not just me. I was on the right. I'm not on the right now. It's not just me on the left who's saying this. My favorite author here is Luigi Zingales, who's a professor at the business school at Chicago. He wrote a fantastic book with a colleague called Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists. And this was exactly his point, that once the capitalists get into power, once they're successful, they use all of their power to get the government to protect them against the next generation of competitors. So the point is not that the system itself is filled with people who are against capitalism. In some sense, they're in favor of the capitalism that got them where they are, but they use their power. And this is the point that people on the right have got to see. They use their power to distort the system to protect themselves. And that makes it impossible for people on the right to get smaller government or simpler taxes or all the things that they're out there arguing and marching for.
And you're talking about trillions that flow into these kind of, or many, many billions that flow into these subsidized sort of, we got a sweet deal with the government. Not really free market business at all situations.
Absolutely, absolutely. As I recount a whole bunch of research that's now coming out about the return on investment from lobbyists, where businesses increasingly recognize that their highest return on investment comes not from inventing the next great widget, but in fact spending money on lobbyists who can get special deals built into the tax code or built into the government spending programs that give them a higher return than any of the investment they would ever make investing in real innovation.
Which is just the opposite of the traditional faith of the right that the free market will come up with great innovation and great change and keep this country at the forefront of the world economy.
Well, none of the best on the right. So people like Milton Friedman were quite clear in distinguishing between the innovation that the market would produce and the corruption that would come from people in the market using government to protect themselves against competitors in the market. So the confusion here is people who are just radically too simplifying about the story that says just we don't have to worry about anything. We do have to worry about the way people will use their power to protect themselves against competition. And that's true on the left and on the right. But on the right in particular, if you want free markets to flourish, we need an environment within which the successful generation can't protect themselves against the next generation of competitors.
Your book is in so many ways a kind of smack in the face, a kind of wake-up call. I mean, you're saying, hey, America, you've gotten too used to this and you've forgotten what it is that's supposed to refresh and replenish this great republic. In fact, it's right in your title. You say the republic is in danger of being lost. Fill that out for us.
Well, by a republic here, what I mean is what the framers meant when they said our republic was a representative democracy. And by a representative democracy, what they said in Federalist 52 was that this was a democracy where the government would be dependent upon the people alone. So the idea here is a kind of marionette relationship. We've got the people and we've got a government dependent upon the people alone. And what we've allowed to happen is a second dependency to develop inside of the system, where members spend between 30 and 70% of their time raising money to get back to Congress, and not raising money from all of us, raising money from a tiny, tiny slice of us. So 0.26% of Americans give $200 or more in a congressional election.
We're talking 0.26%.
0.05% max out in a congressional campaign. So, you know, the Occupy Wall Street people are proud of their, we're the 99%.
Yeah.
It's really understating the matter, right? They're the 99.95% of Americans who don't have the access that the 0.05% Americans have because they're the people who max out in congressional campaigns, and therefore they're the people who get listened to inside of the system.
What is the evidence to you, Lawrence Lessig, that Congress is then working for some tiny percentage of the country rather than the whole?
Well, there's lots of conflicting evidence out there. My favorite is some work by a professor at Princeton, Martin Guilens, who looked at about 1,500 public opinion surveys of attitudes of different Americans. And he took a subset of those, some 887, where the attitudes of the top richest percentage of Americans were different from the attitudes of the rest of America. So the top thinks we should do one thing and the bottom thinks we should do something else. And then he tracked.
And the bottom is a pretty darn big bottom.
Yeah, 90%. Yeah, right. Yeah. So he tracked what American policy actually did, where there was this conflict.
Okay.
Where the top 10% wants one thing and the bottom 90% wants something else.
Mm-hmm.
What did we do? We followed the top 10%. Systematically, we follow the top 10% rather than the bottom 90%. And you look at that and you say, what possible reason could there be for that? Well, some people say the top 10% are the most educated. Turns out that's not true. Hard for a professor to admit.
Mm-hmm.
But education doesn't necessarily produce the wealthiest in America.
Mm-hmm.
What it, in my view, clearly demonstrates is the wealthy are the tiny slice who are giving to campaigns and therefore systematically get the attention of the politicians over everybody else. Now, I'm not saying they can buy any result. The most controversial, the most in-your-face issues are issues which, of course, you're not going to see people flipping their vote in the name of money. That's just too crass. It's too crude. But in a much more subtle way, money works its way inside of the system and increasingly distorts the system against what it would otherwise do if they weren't constantly focused on this pursuit of money.
I guess we know that. I guess we see it. I think it's been around now in such prevalence for so long that a lot of Americans are tempted to think, well, maybe it was always that way in this country.
Yeah, so that's what I found most striking when I started doing this research. In fact, I think it changed in around 1995.
Very recently.
Very recently. It was the election of the Republicans taking over the House of Representatives and therefore Congress for the first time in about 40 years. And Newt Gingrich, who radically changed the character of Washington. I mean, I'm just astonished to see this man running for president right now saying, I'm the guy with experience. It's absolutely true. He is the guy who has most experience in changing the way Washington works. Indeed, beyond Madison, I don't think there's any single American in the history of America who has had more experience in changing the way Washington works.
You don't think campaign contributions worked in your favor as a donor before Newt Gingrich?
The question isn't whether they worked in your favor. The question is whether the whole system had become distorted to focus exclusively on these issues or primarily on these issues rather than focusing on the underlying issues of what's best for the nation. I mean, here's one example. If you ask the question, what was the number one issue Congress focused on in the first quarter of last year?
Okay, yep.
You know, there's a lot going on. We had huge unemployment. We had two wars. We had a budget crisis that was going to lead to the shutdown. So what was the number one issue? The number one issue was, by far, the bank swipe fee controversy.
You mean to let them what was it again?
So when debit cards are used, the banks get a certain amount.
Right.
So the question is, should the banks get more or should they get less and retailers not have to pay as much?
And that's what Congress is all wrapped around for the first quarter.
Why was Congress worried about that? Because the more congressmen danced one way or the other, the more money that rained down upon their campaigns from these two very rich actors who were very eager to get this policy changed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And on this first broadcast day of 2012, we're talking about saving the country, saving the republic, with activist legal thinker Lawrence Lessig. He says, let's act to get corrupting money out of our politics. His book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. And I should say, at our website, there is a terrific slideshow voiced over by Lawrence Lessig, 50 minutes long, so be, you know, tap in when you've got time. But it's great, and you should go when the show's over and check it out. He goes through step by step. It's a terrific piece of work. OnPointRadio.org. Look at this hour's show page there and pass it on. It's really worth passing around. Lawrence Lessig joins me in the studio today. What do you think? Can we do this? Can we clean up our money politics? Do you see money corrupting our politics, our policies, our democracy? Where do you see the corruption? How do we fix it? Lawrence, Larry, a lot of comment here already online. Brian says, the system isn't broken. It's fixed. Get the money out and you get your Congress back. Here's another listener. Ellen says, yes, yes, like we're already there. I'm waiting to hear the solution. We'll come to that. It's not just Americans. I mean, the whole world is watching us, particularly in this election season, and thinking, do they still have the stuff? Can they refresh? Can they replenish? Listen with me, if you would, and listeners. This is the BBC report. This is just today. And they've got the reporter out on the campaign trail. He's talking about the challenges that this great country is facing. You can hear a little Toby Keith's Made in America in the background. Made in
America. An age of tumult and change is reaching into the American heartland. The old rhetoric, the flag, the talk of greatness, the exceptional nation will be in many a campaign commercial. But the reality is of a divided and angry America, straining under its global burden, unable to pay the price for the leadership it has maintained for so long.
And that's not this or that candidate talking. That's the world, the BBC, looking at the United States of America, our country. Lawrence Lessig is with us. The book is Republic Lost. We've got a lot more to hear. And Ellen, we will go to what to do about it and quickly. But a couple callers first. Robert in Bethel, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Tom. Lawrence, thank you so much for giving us a very serious and important wake-up call here in America. I wanted to share with you, I feel politically paralyzed. 30 years ago, I was hoping to get a visa to Russia if President Reagan didn't win. I worked for his campaign. And 30 years later, I'm ready to get a visa to Mars. I find myself not a Republican anymore. I think I'm moving towards the center, which I call political Mesopotamia, where I think the Democrats are moving to the center and the Republicans are fed up on on that side of the ring. And I just feel that the Republican Party, I think you called it right, Lawrence, about 1995. I lived in Massachusetts in the 90s. We had a Republican governor almost three sessions, and the Republican Party never even united anything to do with the Republican Party in Massachusetts to unite people 15 years ago. Now we have a Republican Congress that's forcing the Republican credo down the throats of us Republicans who are just tired and fed up with it. In fact, I have to say, I'm embarrassed. 3 years ago, I started saying, I'm embarrassed to be an American.
But Robert, is it really your credo? Or is Lawrence Lessig right that what we're getting is a kind of, you know, cooked up by big money policy agenda that's not even real free markets, if that's what you want?
Well, Tom, I think Citizens United is the cherry on the top. When the Supreme Court put forth Citizens United, I almost went into heart failure here in Vermont.
Robert, stand by. I'm going to see if my producers can get you a visa to Mars. I hope you never have to use it. We're going to try and fix it right here, and I want to talk about Citizens United. Let me get one more call, and we'll go to it. I appreciate yours. Ivan, in New York City, you're on the air, Ivan.
Yeah, so my point actually is a follow-up on Citizens United. So even when we can get our own legislators in Congress to put forth legislation that would limit the concentration of dollars in the form of corporations and political speech, we get trumped by a Supreme Court decision that says, no, corporations are basically concentrations of people, and people have rights of freedom of speech, and therefore you can't do that. My question, Professor Lessig, is since corporations generally in the country are creatures of the states and not themselves federally chartered, can you have a way to trump the Supreme Court decision short of a constitutional amendment that says states can legislate not the the actions of corporations, but in fact their very charter, their organizational documents that say what they can and cannot do, and attack the issue that way?
Ivan, I love it. All right, let's pick these up. We've got Lawrence Lessig with us. He's a Harvard Law School professor, so he will know something about this. I want to take Robert on first. He's looking for a visa to Mars. And the really behind that is something a lot of Americans, whatever their party can relate to right now, is there hope here? So first, is there hope? And then begin to wade into solutions with us. And Citizens United always comes up right away in these conversations.
Well, I think there is hope, Robert. And actually, I looked it up. You don't need a visa to go to Mars. You're free. You're free
right,
without
you
any permission. But I think that the hope comes from recognizing that we really have two very different parties in America, and they are not Republican versus Democrat. They are inside Washington versus outside Washington. And what's happened over the last 5 to 8 years has been a groundswell of grassroots outrage and anger on both the left and the right. Now, people who look at politics and think just about left versus right immediately want to take these movements and put them into those familiar categories and mm-hmm. see the Tea Party as just a Republican movement or the Occupy Wall Streets as just a Democratic movement. But the most striking thing about Tea Partiers is their fury at the Republican Party, their number one enemy. Yeah. We had Mark Meckler, who's a co-founder of the Tea Party Patriots, say in this event at Harvard, he said, I hate the Republican Party, hate the Republican Party. And the reason he said that is not because the things they say they are for are things he's against. Mm-hmm. He's for the same things that they say they're for. But they have no integrity, he said, because they're constantly being driven by interests which are not the interests of those values. And so I think what Americans have to do is recognize reluctantly we, the sovereign, have to wake up. You know, this is the giant sleeping. We've got to wake up and recognize it's our responsibility to shake up the system enough to get us back to a place where when we fight mm-hmm. about whether we should be more liberal or more conservative, and one side wins, the values behind that victory actually translate into policy, as opposed to being blocked by the traditional special interests who can avoid any real change.
We'll come to the how, but I want to be clear on this. I mean, in your book, you're very clear that, Republicans are not the only ones in this net of money influence at all.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what happened in the 1990s and the 2000 period is that the Democrats and the Republicans became the same party with respect to business interests. So the Republicans and the Democrats were as eager as they could be to please Wall Street and to make Wall Street believe that they could give Wall Street everything Wall Street wanted. But with respect to social issues, they became more and more disparate. But that, again, makes sense of the fundraising. So you become business with respect to business issues, so business gives you money. You become extremist with respect to social issues, so that the extremists on the social issues, whether on the left or the right, will do as much as they possibly can to support your extreme agenda. So you become more anti-gay, or you become more supportive of women's right to choose in the context of abortion. And that's a way to continue to drive the fundraising movement. So I think the parties on both sides are to blame. And I, though I'm a reformed Republican, I would not say the Democrats are any better at this.
I want to come to how we begin to tackle this. And it's clear right from the get-go, this is not an easy thing. A sleeping giant doesn't move around nimbly. But when you get the people really engaged, Lawrence Lessig maintains confidence that they can get back on top of this and revive the republic. That's what the founders gave us. A couple of callers input here first. Buffalo, New York. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I had a question with a point, and you've already touched on it a little bit. The question is, how many of the top contributors gave to competing campaigns so that no matter who won, they would have their influence? And the point is, does it matter if I vote for one person or the other, since the same person's going to be controlling them, or the same interests are going to be controlling them?
There's that paralyzing fear, does it even matter, that drives people out of this system.
Right. Rationally drives them out of the system, because you're exactly right. Interests give on both sides of the campaign. And they give partly because that's the way to get access. But they also give to make credible one of the most important forces in this dynamic, which is the threat that if you don't do what we want, we're going to support the other side. If you never give to the other side, that's not a credible threat. But if you're nimble and move between both sides, then everybody in the center is constantly aware that if they don't do what you want, they're going to be punished. I mean, I was on a panel with Evan Bive, who retired senator
Indiana.
From Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he was responding to somebody who said, the evidence isn't really clear that money buys results in politics. And he kind of rolled his eyes and he said, you just got to recognize the way the world has changed. After Citizens United, to go back to that question.
Mm-hmm.
After Citizens United, 30 days out of an election, the thing every incumbent fears is that somebody is going to walk in and drop $1 million in a district to destroy the incumbent. And so the only way the incumbent can get insurance against that is before it happens to cozy up to the independent expenditures on his side.
Rush to the money.
That's right. Rush to money. And so to clear yourself in advance to make sure that when you get hit, there's somebody who can come in and defend you. And how do you clear yourself in advance? You do everything they want you to do. So without spending a dime,
mm-hmm.
they get all the influence they need just because of the threat that there's going to be somebody who steps in and does something
about it. What to do? We'll go to it one more first. Dana in Verchere, Vermont. Dana, you're on the air.
Hi. What I've been wondering ever since I listened to Justice Breyer and read his book was, what about the possibility of getting rid of the legislature completely and take a page out of Italy's book and do everything by national referendum via computer?
Occupy the computer and everybody vote on everything, every jot and tittle. Well, talk about fed up with Congress, Lawrence.
Yeah, so I'm not a believer in direct democracy. I spent 9 glorious years in California, and it only took 1 or 2 to recognize that anything getting close to direct democracy can be a disaster. And
with
that's
all
because,
the referenda on the ballot
right.
there year after year.
And people don't know what they're voting on, and all sorts of crazy things happen. And that's not because we're stupid. It's because we're busy. We have a life. You know, we've got kids.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a job. We've got 2 jobs if we're lucky. Like, we're doing as many things as we possibly can. And we want to hire people who are in the position of trying to figure out what is in the best interest of the nation or the interest of the state and to represent us and to do that work well. And if you're telling me that for us to have a government, I've got to cut out 4 hours of my day and sit down and read through the most tedious and difficult legislative questions that we face.
It's just not going to happen.
It's just not going to happen. And instead, what's going to happen is that the special interests are going to have a field day in that world,
mm-hmm.
because they can much more easily—
By the television time,
exactly,
sway us and all.
So I think we've got to work on getting a representative democracy working. And we can do that, I think, by destroying this corrupting influence of money inside of our system.
Jack Abramoff, par excellence at that, says, he says, I was participating in a system of legalized bribery. And he's talking about working with Congress. He said, all of it is bribery, every bit of it. Lawrence Lessig writes that for the Republic, the prognosis is not good. But he says, few who work to understand what has gone wrong will be willing to accept defeat without a fight. So fight for what? Help us here. Give us a pointer.
Well, so let's start with what the solution looks like. If the problem is that Congress is responsive to its funders, but its funders are only 0.26% of the American people, or 0.05% of the American people.
Right.
You tell me which you think is more relevant. Then the solution is to build a system where the funders are the people. The funders are all of us. So that when they're responsive to the funders, they're responsive to us. So a number of people and
but
a number of states.
Is that just doling out campaign finance money to anybody who says I'm
a number of states, up? Three states, have adopted what we could think of as small dollar funding systems for elections. And I, in my book, propose a slight variation on that. So let me just talk about my proposal.
Okay, good.
So my proposal is, take the first $50 that all of us contribute to our treasury.
In annual taxes or?
In any form of taxes,
okay,
payroll taxes.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. And rebate it in the form of a democracy voucher. So you have a $50 democracy voucher.
Practically every adult would in that
Absolutely.
Case.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that $50 democracy voucher you can then give to any candidate who agrees to fund his campaign only with democracy vouchers plus contributions of up to $100 from any individual.
So any candidate says, no big money, but I'll take lots and lots of these. But, geez, isn't big money a lot simpler? Will they go for that?
Well, the question is whether the numbers are right. In Connecticut, where they adopted not this system, but a similar system, 88% of candidates opted into the small dollar funded system in the first year. So if you get the numbers right, it's just a question of incentives. What's the easier way to run a winning campaign?
Yeah.
And if you have a small dollar system that is credible and has enough money in the system, then the point is that candidates will at least be pressured to consider this as an alternative, and candidates who don't adopt this as an alternative will be quickly branded as the big money candidate.
If we did it nationally, how does the money in that pot of 50 bucks times how many millions compare to the money in the pot of, I don't know, corporate and private big money contributions?
Well, $50 a voter is close to $7 billion in election system. Election cycle, $7 billion.
That's
the
a
total
lot.
Amount
yeah.
raised in 2010 was $1.8 billion. So it's three times the total amount raised in 2010. And the point is that's just the voucher. Then the voucher is plus $100 contributions. This is easily more money than's in the system right now. But the point is it's not the corrupting money that's in the system right now.
It's citizen by citizen saying, here's my $50. I like what you're saying.
I like what you're saying. And I, of course, am not expecting that for my $50, you're going to do anything to distort what you're doing. And so that when the candidate does something that's stupid, you might think it might be because he's stupid or because he's a Republican or because he's a Democrat, but it's not because of the money.
Not because he was just bought with a $500,000 dropped on him.
Exactly right. And that's the thing we've got to believe, to begin to believe that our government is credible again, to make it make sense for us to want to get back into the system.
You get even bigger than this. We'll get up to Citizen United territory and the U.S. Constitution itself and maybe some amending to go on there. But let's just take this one. $50 per citizen to put down on the candidate or candidates that they like. Will Congress ever vote for that? Or is that like, hey, tap, tap on the shoulder. You don't go near that or you're toast next
to
them.
So that's the really depressing part. I think it's easy to describe what the answer is, but it's extraordinarily hard to imagine this Congress actually adopting it. And that's because if you change the way we funded campaigns, an enormously valuable industry called the industry of lobbying becomes radically less valuable. Because lobbying gets a lot of its value, not all of it, but a lot of its value out of the fact that they are the machers. They are the people in the middle of the system.
They know how to get in there and make it happen.
And they channel campaign funds in a way that make them essential. And if all of a sudden they were not doing that, they would just be policy wonks. And they would be paid what policy wonks are paid, but that policy wonks aren't paid the $1 million that lobbyists
And they're sitting right now as we speak all around the necks of Congress.
Right. So if you imagine and the other part about this, which is also equally depressing, is that so many members of Congress, as Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, told me, think of Capitol Hill as a farm league for K Street. They kind of think of their
service. Become lobbyists, big money lobbyists themselves.
Become lobbyists themselves. And if all of a sudden lobbying is no longer valuable, that's not a valuable job. So why would they ever choose something like this?
Okay, so it's hard to do, but we're sick of this. We want to change it. How?
So that's the point about outsider politics. We've got to begin to encourage this idea that citizens who are not themselves politicians and don't want to become politicians can begin to organize these grassroots movements on the left and the right that could begin to push for this kind of change. And that's the critical insight, I think, that comes from recognizing what's been happening over the last 8 years.
Is that Tea Party? Is that Occupy? Is that
it's
the beginnings
both.
Of it?
It's both. That's the point. It's both. It's got to see how these two can be woven together to produce exactly that kind of change.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking on the first broadcast day for us of 2012 about, well, no less than saving the country, saving the American Republic with activist, legal thinker Lawrence Lessig. He says, let's act to get corrupting money out of our politics. His new book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. And I will say again, you should go to onpointradio.org, check out under this under the page for this hour's broadcast, his terrific voiced-over slideshow of what's wrong and how to fix it. It is a great tool that you will want to pass around from that page. Lawrence, we've got all kinds of comments online here. I mean, people saying, you know, the problem is those with the power to take the money out of the system are the system, as you say yourself. You know, all kinds of answers. Old man writes, give anyone elected to Congress a livable wage for life and a life sentence in jail if they receive any sort of outside compensation beyond that. He says, I work in finance. The SEC wants to know if I receive so much as a T-shirt. Congress should be held to the same standard. People are really listening here on Twitter. By the way, we're talking about Twitter tomorrow. But Rand says, quoting you, return on investment for business lobbying is higher than anything else they do. That gets people's attention. And this question on Twitter from Driver. Please ask Mr. Lessig, R.E., can we reverse corporate personhood and speech is money, i.e., can we get out of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision? How?
So I empathize with the strong movement of people who think that Citizens United was wrongly decided and needs to be reversed. I also think it's a little bit of a distraction. You know, if we went back to January 20th, 2010, the day before Citizens United was decided, democracy in America was already broken. It's not that Citizens United broke it. Mm. We already had a system where the tiniest fraction of America was guiding public policy as opposed to the rest of Americans. So, of course, if I could tomorrow snap my fingers and get the Supreme Court to reverse that decision, I would do that. But the idea that we need to motivate a political movement towards reversing Citizens United alone is, in my view, a mistake.
So there's not a difference in scale? I mean, look at the numbers pouring into the presidential candidate right now. You've got individuals out there talking about putting in as much as $20 million, single people, let alone 0.26%.
Yeah. I don't disagree that this election is going to be hugely affected by independent expenditures. And I actually think that the terror that Evan Bayh was describing of an incumbent, like terrified about the idea that independent money is going to come in and destroy his incumbency, might actually be the incentive necessary to bring about the change, because it used to be the incumbents were in power. Now the incumbents are just waiting around for some bomb to be dropped on top of them. So I'm not saying that these are insignificant. I'm saying that a political movement for reform has got to talk about more than just reversing Citizens United.
Okay.
It's got to get people to recognize that we have got to have a way of funding elections that doesn't force candidates to look to the 0.26% of America to fund their campaigns. We've got to have a conversation about the need for what sounds like a terrible word, public funding in our election system. And unless we have that as part of the solution, we will never have a solution. So limit contributions alone will always find a way for this influence to find a new way into the market. What instead we've got to find is a way to fund the market with the right kind of influence.
But even if you do public funding, how do you shoulder past the influence of Citizens United? Let's say that your plan goes into effect, but here there's still that money. It can be concentrated. It can land on the desk, you know, in the pocket of one candidate who says to that money, I will do what you like, help me win, and they will do it.
Right. So to amend the Constitution requires two-thirds of Congress to propose an amendment and three-fourths of the states to ratify it.
By which you're saying ain't going to happen.
Ain't going to happen.
At least
with
the two-thirds.
Right.
Okay.
But if we had a Congress elected in a way that was not dependent upon the tiny fraction of America funding their elections, there's at least a chance that they could begin to have members of Congress, more members of Congress, who are willing to stand up and say, we have got to find a way to change the ability of these independent expenditures to radically control the way our system functions.
But there's the chicken and egg. How do you get to that Congress when you get all the money sitting there?
So I think we have got to be able to do two things at once, walk and chew gum at the same time.
Yeah.
We've got to push for reform inside of this Congress, which is clean money inside of this Congress. And my proposal or any of these proposals would be a step in that direction.
But and,
the
second and with step, that, if I may just pause on that for a second, you're really talking about a super elevation of political awareness about money so that Congress people become afraid to operate off of money.
Absolutely. Every single congressman who shows up at any public event, the first question that should be asked is, where are you on the question of the corrupting influence of money in Congress, and what are you going to do about it? And force every one of them to feel this is the number one issue and constantly get them to face this so that eventually we begin to get a Congress that's more interested in trying to address it without amending the Constitution. But at the same time, we have been pushing for a process for amending the Constitution that Congress can't itself control. The framers, when they thought about how to amend the Constitution, gave us two paths. Okay. One is Congress proposes the amendment.
Yep.
And then somebody said, well, what happens if Congress is the problem?
If they won't.
And they won't. So the framers added a second way, which is that states can call on Congress to have a convention which itself proposes the amendments, which then the states have to ratify. So we have been pushing.
So states can initiate at the state level.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. So we've been pushing for a process to get states to begin to call for a convention at which the kind of reform that I think we need and other reform that other people think we need could be debated. And then the best ideas from that would be carried out and proposed to the rest of the states for ratification.
What's the amendment? What is the amendment or amendments that if – that's a long piece of work you just described. But if it happened, now we've got a constitutional convention, what's the tweaking that you would do with this sacred document, but it's ours? We can change it if we want to. It's written right. What would you change?
Yeah. So I think there are three essential changes. And maybe we could add four if you want to take care of the people who care about corporate personhood. So the number one change is constitutionally we have to mandate that public elections are publicly funded. And I think it should be small dollar funding. And I don't think bureaucrats should choose how much money people have. All of that is a detail. The point is elections have to be publicly funded. Number two, I think contributions to elections should be capped. And I take my hero here, Buddy Romer, the only Republican in the race who's actually talking about this issue, has self-limited himself so that he takes no more than $100 from anybody. I think that should be the cap. We should say people should contribute, but no more than $100.
And Buddy Romer, who listens to this show and is often retweeting what we're talking about here, retweet that, Buddy.
Yeah. And number three, I think that Congress has to have the power to limit, but not to ban, independent expenditures, both by individuals and corporations. So I don't think any Congress should have the power to say a corporation cannot say something or cannot spend a limited amount of money to express their positions. But the thing we have to give Congress the power to do is to make it so that independent expenditures don't dominate the system so much that everybody is constantly shape-shifting in light of the independent expenditures.
Right.
Those three changes would fix the system. Now, if you want to add one more that says corporations are not persons, I'm okay with that, but I'm just frustrated by movements that think that if we just get Congress, if we just get an amendment that says corporations are not persons, somehow magically all of the influence of wealth disappears inside of the system. It doesn't. You've got to change the way we fund our elections if you're going to change the way the elections corrupt Congress.
Let's get essential then. About, let's say that these were on the table. I mean, and there's the whole other question. Once you have a constitutional convention, heaven knows what's going to come out of it. And some people may be scared to walk in that room given the influence of money right now. You could end up going the other way. But let's say it's the changes that you propose, that you describe here. Are those consistent, to your mind, with the sort of founding vision of this country? Or did the founders themselves expect that people of means would have that extra margin of influence that would kind of maybe inevitably grow in what's in the Constitution now?
So my favorite clause in the Constitution.
I'm not sure, even if they thought that, maybe we should still change it, but I'm curious what you.
So my favorite clause has come to be the Emoluments Clause. And in the Emoluments Clause, Congress is forbidden from taking gifts from foreign princes.
Now, yes.
So what were they thinking? Right? Why would that be in the Constitution? From states, kings, or foreign princes? Mm-hmm.
We don't want the sultan of or the prince of, you name it.
What they were worried about was that Congress would develop a dependency on this outside source of income that would distract them from the thing they were supposed to be focused upon, which is the people. Now, corporations and the wealthy have become the foreign princes of the day.
So you say if they've got an American passport or an American headquarters and address, what makes them foreign? I mean, in constitutional terms,
No, I'm saying
not.
In the sense that they are distracting Congress from the focus they are supposed to have upon the people. Mm-hmm. So if you're spending 70% of your time raising money, your number one concern is how do I keep my funders happy, not what do I need to do to keep my people happy. So I think the framers would have completely recognized the need to block this kind of distorting influence.
Weren't they? I mean, those were guys of means themselves.
Some of them were, of course. But they didn't think that there would be anything like the elections that we have right now. They never even thought about this problem. They didn't think somebody should campaign for office. They thought it was indiscreet. It was improper to go out and to run a campaign for Congress. It was people would decide who was the appropriate senior person in their district who should be a member, and that's who they would send to Congress. So Madison would, you know, constantly be pushed to go out and to run, and he thought it was just indecent to have to run. So they didn't think about this problem, and they certainly didn't think about the cost of television media or the cost of campaign polling as part of the system.
I mean, in a way, we have to have faith that whatever means they had, whatever influence they had themselves as gentlemen of the time, if they really believed in a republic, which is what they described and what they laid out, it can only get so distorted and still work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they were so obsessed with improper dependency. Corruption as a sense of improper dependency was, as Zephyr Teachout has written in a fantastic article, the core thing they talked about more than any other issue, how to avoid corruption. Yet for some reason, we have forgotten today their conception of corruption, which is exactly the sense of an institution that becomes dependent on the wrong influence. And that's exactly what our Congress is.
Let's go to Iowa, where it's all happening this week. Sharon in Mason City, Iowa. Sharon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I definitely appreciate this conversation. I'm a state representative, and I see the money being an issue. Not all the time in state politics, but some of the time. And I appreciate this conversation. My question is, I had two questions. I know there are states that have tried the public funding, but you still have the problem of the super PACs coming in and politicking for their particular candidate. And I don't see a way of getting rid of that unless we address that on the federal level. And I had a question about that. And also the $50 that citizens would give to the candidate that they liked the message. They liked hearing the message of how would the candidate get that message out without funding?
That chicken and egg. Right. If you can't get it out on TV or afford the ads, how do you do? These are good questions. Thank you, Sharon. I'm glad you're listening there. What do you say to our state rep in Iowa?
Right. Great question. So the first one, absolutely. And again, I think that what we've got to think of is the sequence of reform. What do we need first? And so we need to have a system where representatives feel independent enough that they can then take the step necessary to get a constitutional amendment to change the Citizens United rule. So I think eventually we need to be able to limit independent expenditures. That means limit super PACs. But I again think limit means limit. It doesn't need ban. It doesn't mean that we should
But how do you get there again? Right now, there's Sharon. She and the country are watching Newt Gingrich saying, hey, Mitt Romney's rolling over me with this big money coming in. What's he say, $3.5 million?
Romney and Barack Obama, they're both. I mean, we're going to see the super PAC-funded elections this time more than any time in our history. Absolutely. But the question is, what do we do to get 67 votes in the United States Senate that could propose an amendment? And I think the only way to do that is to get more people inside of Congress who think clean money, number one.
Mm-hmm.
As to the second question, you're right. There is a chicken and egg problem.
The 50 bucks, how do you get all those contributions in? How do you get your word out?
Exactly right. And as we begin to map out what this proposal looks like, there's some way to think about advancing on the $50 that you could be getting as a candidate once you credibly qualify inside the system. And I think this is a detail that absolutely has to be added into the system. But we've got to think about the benefits and the cost of the alternative. The cost of the alternative is how do you get into the system initially? But the benefits are that the people who are in are not people you think are there because of the money.
Tim in Harlan, Kentucky. Tim, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you letting me talk on here. I'm on a cell phone right now. I'm coming home from working, and my wife works, and we are very concerned about what's going on. And I believe what the gentleman here is talking about, all his proposals sound pretty spot on to me, a layperson. But one of the things I think that would be necessary for such a sweeping change is we need to put collars on the congressional people that we have in office right now. Right now, they are answerable to themselves. They control their own wages. They control the if there is any kind of fallout. If they're caught doing something wrong, they give themselves a slap on the wrist.
And Tim, how do you put a collar on Congress? It's supposed to be the institution representing us.
Well, see, that's the thing. The us that it's representing is the incorporated us, not the regular us. And what we need to have is an independent oversight capability, not an independent committee of congressmen we need to have, and I hate to be the one to say it, and I'm sure everybody would be ready to yell at me, but we need to have a bureaucratical system. We need to have people that are not involved in this money system.
What about voters being the independent oversight, Tim? Isn't that our job?
The problem is being able to get to the information, digging through 40, 50 pages of bill legislation yep. that is changed minute by minute before the actual vote. And then in the process of the voting, they're taking out, they're splitting from Washington.
Yeah, I hear it, Tim. I appreciate your call. You're paying close attention here. But how do we do it? Tim wants to know some sort of kind of... He wouldn't say this, but it sounds like almost magic, a perfect oversight group to come in and do this. But that is our job, isn't it? I mean, how can somebody else oversee Congress? That's what voters do. We've got a minute and a half. How would you change the culture, arrange things so that we get power lined up from the people that performs that function?
Yeah, so Tim's proposal would require a constitutional change, too. And so the question is, which kind of constitutional change should we be pushing for first? I think the one we need to push for is one that gives us confidence in the representative system working. And that means we need to recognize we the people are not going to be full-time legislators, full-time monitors, full-time engaged in what's going on in Washington because we have kids, we have hobbies, we have jobs. We need to create a system where when people go to Washington, we have a reason to trust them. We don't have that system right now because right now they go to Washington, they spend all their time talking to 0.26% of America as opposed to all of us. So which change should we get first? I think clean the money inside the system and then limit the external influence so that we don't doubt that they have integrity inside the system. And then we can begin to get back to a democracy and a republic that we have faith in.
And it means the first question, as Lawrence Lessig says, is to every politician, where's your money come from? Where does your money come from? And get it on the table. That requires hypervigilance, but there's a game plan here and there's a vision of it, and that is a start in any circumstance. And Lawrence Lessig, we're very grateful for that. The new book is Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Check out the terrific slideshow with his narration at our website, onpointradio.org. Lawrence Lessig, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, let's go. 2012, let's clean up all we can and keep it rolling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.